Hello, dear Gestalten podcast listener. My name is Martin Groschwald, and welcome to a new episode of our absolutely lovely podcast. And for this one, I am actually very excited. I know I've said this a few times already on the pod, but I'm genuinely excited about this one because I think we've never had a designer on an episode of such a recent car, but also such an important car, let's say an important brand. And I'm talking about the Porsche 992 and its designer, Ben Baum. So Ben actually took about an hour of his time, sat down with me. We talked about the 992. We talked about Porsche as a design organization. We talked about some of the good things. We talked about some of the, you know, things that can be better in the future at Porsche, but also we talked about why he left Porsche and the Volkswagen Group. He was in Beijing for, you know, a couple of years to start work for a startup called Li Xiang in Beijing. So I hope you will enjoy this as much as I did. And without further ado, Porsche 992, designed by Ben Baum, in conversation with me, Martin Groschwald, at the Gestalten Podcast. Let's go. Ben Baum, welcome to the Gestalten Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you. And I am recording this straight out of Paris. You are sitting in Beijing. And I think we've never had a more international podcast. I think it was always either Munich or somewhere else. Or like, you know, my partner in crime in recording podcasts was in the same location. But it's never been that I was not in Munich or in a show. And so I think it's the longest distance I've ever recorded a podcast. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you for having me, man. The future just started. I feel like it, you know, like you're sitting in Paris, I'm sitting in Beijing. That's kind of crazy.
Incredible. Yeah. Incredible. Off the charts. But let's crack on. And we want to talk about a couple of things. We want to talk a little bit about your past, because your past is very interesting. But we also want to talk quite a bit about your present and the future. And let's talk about the past, first of all. And a lot of people know that you have had quite a few years at Porsche. And you were, alongside with a colleague, the lead designer for the latest 992, which is, of course, a 911 for our listeners that are not aware of the model naming in Porsche. And let me ask you this question up front. How was it to design probably the most iconic car that is out there right now? A 911, was there pressure? Was this a kind of, did you understand what you're doing at this moment in time? Or how did you feel about doing a 911?
I think the feeling was less spectacular than you would have thought. Because you are in, you know, like you work every day, like it's a very, you're in your daily business. And then like one day your design boss will come and tell you, okay, we start a 992 now. And of course, in the first 2-3 weeks or 4 weeks, even, you are like pretty excited about it. But after, like, for example, the scale phase, my scale phase, because I had the first scale model in the team, was almost or more than 1 year. So when you work more than 1 year on a scale model or on several scale models, it kind of gets boring, I have to say.
I can imagine that. And how is that process? I mean, if you ask designers, and there's so many of them would say, I would love to do like a 911 at some point in my career. How can, you know, the normal person imagine that a process like this works? Is this actually like, you know, you're being told like, look, we're using a similar platform of what we have done before. So like, you know, and obviously the pressure of the history that comes with it as well. Where is the creativity coming for such a project that is so iconic, where you have to be more scared about changing anything than probably brave about pushing something forward? Because I can imagine the tradition holds back a lot in projects like this.
That's definitely the case. So you have to always think, how far can I go and how far must I go? In this particular project, it was kind of open in the beginning, because when we started the project, we were still out in Renningen, which was a satellite studio in Stuttgart, basically, of Porsche because our old studio was way, 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 way too small. And so we had the task of like, just imagine how could the next 992 look like. We actually worked parallel to the proportion model, which was done in the proportion studio in Vlacht. And we got actually all the freedom we wanted. So in the beginning, it was very, very open. But during the process, of course, this narrows down. And like then the models get more and more and more and more similar. Until in the end, when we had the two full-size models of Thomas and me, they were almost the same. So basically, but this is like a very, very long process. I think it's also like, it's something like getting used to a design, which is happening within the studio. So at first your design boss will see like, ah, no, I don't like this blade rear light. It's somehow weird. It makes like, it doesn't look right. And then after some weeks seeing it again, he will be saying, ah, yeah, maybe I like it. Maybe it's cool. And it's actually on every piece and every part of the 992, it was exactly like that. So at first it was always like, ah, I don't know, should we go like this, should we do that? And then the only thing which you have to do as a designer, as a young designer, is stick to your idea and be sure what you're doing.
Would you say this actually helped you in something like Porsche? Because, you know, obviously we talked a little bit about this beforehand and stuff, and you said because it's such a traditional kind of company, to push something very radical is relatively difficult. And you can imagine doing something, you know, the same and probably Mercedes and BMW, pushing for something new is not always very easy. Do you think you were rewarded for taking a little bit of risk with this kind of, especially like the light system on the rear, that was just, you know, non-traditional?
Yeah, I think the reward comes when you think a bit further. So like, it's just like, It's really basic thinking. So my thoughts about the rear lamps were, okay, in the future, like we will have a lot of brands, because actually Audi was at the same time planning to do like a complete light band in the rear. And I thought to myself, okay, all of these brands will have this light band in the rear, and we have to have something which makes us stand out and not be like confused with any other brand. So I was thinking, okay, let's add these like little black winglets, which are actually my first thoughts behind that was it could help for the Spülluft. I don't know how this is called in English. So like for the air, for the turbos. But in the end, it didn't work out, but that's where the basic idea comes from. And actually on every part you change the car, you have to have a certain thinking behind that. But basically that's the way I design, and I can't design in a different way. That's also very restrictive in a weird way, because I could never, for example, work for a super stylish brand like, I don't know, Toyota or something, even though I kind of like the design sometimes, but I just can't understand it.
Mm-hmm. So when I ask you this thing, I mean, we talk about the, you know, to the point where you're leaving Porsche, but when you work at Porsche and you happen to be in this fortunate position of working on the sports car, so like the 911, and you see the SUVs, you see things such as the Panamera, and I know you're a person that is very driven by, you know, your own beliefs in that kind of sense. Is this sometimes difficult to see, like, you know, we're doing these fantastic sports cars, it's almost like the perfect symbiosis of design and engineering, and then you see the SUVs and you understand, okay, yeah, they're being sold. But how does it make you feel with somebody, you know, who has this personal attitude of just like sticking to brands, understanding what brands are, and then you see the SUVs? Was this difficult sometimes to kind of accept that economically, yes, we have to do this, but for the brand, oof, difficult?
Yeah, and I actually also think economically we don't have to do it. We have to do it to have like more sales volume, of course. But if you have a look at the figures, the profit, like the rate of profit, went down in the last couple of years of Porsche because the volume went up. So I think sticking to your core beliefs of the brand is for me actually very, very important. That's why I'm a huge fan of Ferrari, for example, because they always stuck to their way of doing something, and they still make a lot of money. And I think for Porsche, there would have been a similar way. But of course, modern management tells you it's only about exponential growth, or it's only about growth. Only if a company grows, it works, which I think is actually outdated kind of management. But we will see where it ends up when the whole planet is used, you know?
So let me ask you this question. If you would have gone back to Porsche and taken something off the history, what would you have done instead of maybe an SUV? I mean, there's always these kind of talks, and, like, you know, enthusiasts would love to see a 914 again. Is that a kind of direction, or would you go more 928 or 944? What's your if you would have kept it core at the core of Porsche, what would you have done?
I would do all of them, actually. I have to say, I would do a 914 electric, small, like for younger people, actually, to get like a fresher wind, like to get refresh the brand, because like the Porsche customer is 55 by now, to get like young people interested in the brand. And I would do a 924, 944, because like this is a sports car brand, and you have to somehow celebrate their values. And I can tell you, there was a 940, kind of 940 project back in the days, which was done by a Canadian designer, which then went to Tesla. And this car was awesome, man. It was really, really great. This would be the first, actually, I've never thought about buying a new car, but this would have been a car which I would have bought. So, but actually the car industry doesn't make cars anymore for car enthusiasts. So it doesn't, so, you know, that's actually hard to digest in the end.
Which is quite sad. But I think if you think about Porsche being part of the Volkswagen group, I mean, Volkswagen had, if we look back, the XL1, which was a fantastic, very small series production. I think they only did like 100 or 200 of the XL1s. But if you would have used something like this as a platform, maybe a tiny little big, bit bigger, a 914 could have blown everything out of the park. You know, I mean, this would have been the perfect kind of thinking process behind it.
Interesting that you say that. Maybe that was the platform for this kind of car. But I'm not saying that it was, but maybe.
Yeah. No, but, you know, I mean, this is the kind of big advantages of having these massive groups behind something, because you can play with these ideas.
Yeah.
But the masses is of course what is really important nowadays. It's like, you know, you need to have the volume. You need to have the presence so that that everybody sees what you're doing, and, you know, that it's there. And I have to tell you, I was wandering around through Paris, you know, a couple of days ago, and you don't see a lot of sports cars here. You see small vehicles, very utilitarian vehicles in that sense, like Peugeots and Renaults. And compared to my usual home, which is Munich, it's actually very nice not to see the big ones. You know, it's like, and I was like, oh, cool. Have the small cars, and why shouldn't, you know, even sports cars companies, I mean, look at Lotus and Caterham, for example. They make small and very well received sports cars, so why not do like a 914 based on something like that?
Exactly. By the way, the designer of that car was Julien Bilodeau. I was thinking about, man, what's his name? A really, really good designer, and now at Tesla, left Porsche. But yeah, exactly. So actually, that would be the first thing I would do if I would be CEO of Porsche. But yes, I'm not.
Well, then let's actually talk about this. What made you leave Porsche? What was the reason for you to say, I'll take that step? And to put a little bit perspective into this is, you didn't leave Porsche one day to another. What you did is you went to the Volkswagen Future Center in Beijing, did an exchange there, and then you left. So first of all, what brought you over to China? And then in the end, what made you say, like, and now I'm doing something different?
So the first step was, I was quite bored in the studio and at Porsche. Because when you do it like for eight, nine years, the same stuff, then it's getting kind of boring. I mean, we, for example, restarted the next generation for the Boxster three times, you know, you do three times the same model. It's like, okay. So I thought, okay, I want to do something more, something new. And they offered me actually to go to Beijing. And I said, yeah, why not? It's like about future mobility. It's about the products which will help the people to get around better, which will maybe solve some issues which big cities have. And I was quite interested in that. And also, you have to know, in a big studio like Porsche, an exterior designer has to be very short-sighted. So it's basically just about sketching and modeling in 3D, and that's it. If you have more what you want to think about, then you are definitely wrong in an exterior design studio. So, and also, somehow I missed the perspective, you know, like, I couldn't see myself, where would I be in 10 years at Porsche still doing the same like designs I do now? For me, that was not a good outlook.
So you went over to Beijing.
Yeah.
And the Future Center, of course, for Volkswagen, I mean, they do everything. From, you know, EVTOLs to cars to city, all these kind of things. What changed for you there? Did you have a mindset change in this environment just because it was a completely not production car related work? Or what happened for you in those, I think it was 2 years that you were there, from a mindset perspective?
Actually, not that much. Actually, I just found out that this is exactly the way I want to work. So more responsibility, more of a concept thinking, more of a complete thinking behind the product and process, you know, like understanding the product even before we start sketching on the skin of something. So because shortly before I left to Beijing, I started my own company on the side as well, where we do products, like mobility products. And actually, I figured out with these two kind of new things going on in my life, like Beijing and my own company, that I really like to think a bit further, you know, do all the planning and have thoughts about how do I manufacture something, what kinds of system do they have to have inside, where can we position our brand, and all these kind of things you never think about when you are in a studio, of course. And that was super interesting for me. And so I made the decision that after Beijing, I would start my own little startup. But then, of course, something else happened.
Well, this is, we come to Li Xiang in just a little bit, but I wanna ask you something very interesting that you've just mentioned now and go a little bit deeper into this. In a general kind of transportation or car design environment, why do you think that this kind of idea about branding, about positioning, manufacturing within the design studio is not really pushed for or asked for by the designers? Because isn't it kind of important for the designer to understand where the products should be based rather than just to do a product? Or, I mean, you know, this is the question I ask myself, is, you know, the designers should give it a certain kind of direction why the product is there, and, you know, they can tell the story. But it's oftentimes seems to me, A, it's not wanted by management, or B, a lot of people just want to sketch.
Yeah, I think it's both. And I think it's also the design schools which are pushing that. So, for example, I'm like not a traditional Pforzheim guy. I'm actually an industrial design student or industrial designer from Graz. And we had a very different approach to go to design our products. And I can't see that. Like I can see that in some guys in the car industry, but a lot of guys just want to sketch. You know, it's just like about, okay, I make something new. It looks cooler than the last one. That's it. And for me, that's a bit short-sighted thinking, because you will end up always in the same loop again and again. And actually, I think you're totally right with saying that it's the responsibility of a design team to give a future outlook also about the brand values, about how the brand will be perceived from the customer. Because marketing, for example, can't do it. Marketing is always backsided. They always look in the past and say, oh, okay, like they are selling SUV cabrios now, so let's do an SUV cabrio. You know, like kind of this stuff. You have to, as a designer, I think you have to have a vision, and you have to sell your vision to your CEO or to your board. And if you can't do that, then you're maybe just a stylist and not a designer, which is also okay. I mean, like, for me, there is a difference between a designer and a stylist. I think at Porsche, it's the name Porsche Style, which is the name of the studio, is actually right, because we are more stylists than we are designers at Porsche.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's ever going to change?
I think it has to change somehow, because for me, some brands seem to be on a dead end at the moment. And I actually don't know. This would be like looking in my glass wall and seeing like, oh, I don't know. But I would hope so, because it's actually fun to do. It's actually fun to create a vision and to stand behind certain values for a brand. It makes me actually, I can tell you now that since I'm here at Li Xiang, I've never been more happier at work. And like people would say now, oh yeah, but he was working at a Chinese startup. How can he do? But it's, you can't imagine how different this is to a big 100-year-old brand.
Yeah, well, let me ask the question, and then we get into Li Xiang in detail. What did your friends tell you when you said like you're leaving officially Porsche? Of course, at that point you were in Beijing already, but you were leaving Porsche for a Chinese startup. What were your friends and all these kind of guys saying? I mean, this is almost like, you know, you step from the highest level that you can reach in terms of probably brands, especially for German brands, putting it that way, into the world of the unknown. What did your friends and what did your colleagues say?
So, the people who really know me, they said, okay, do it, go for it. And the other people, of course, said, man, how can you? Are you crazy? Some people made actually bets how long I will stay here. They were like, 3 months and then you will quit. Like, I think the shortest one was 1 month and I will quit. But it's kind of, to be honest, I've never felt really at home at Porsche, because maybe in the beginning, like in the very, very beginning when we were in the old studio and it had this family feeling, and you felt like, you know, like it still had kind of this garage feeling, which is completely unbelievable. But 10 years ago, it still had this kind of, yeah, we're doing something cool here. You know, we have not the fanciest place, but we are doing awesome sports cars. And in these 10 years, it really changed to a kind of, I don't want to be like mean, but in the kind of, to a kind of snobbish place, where it's like really just about, okay, I work at Porsche, you know, I have a leasing car, look at me. And I was like, wow, cool.
It's the problem about size as well, you know, and it's of course, if you look back, and I think a lot of people will tell you this who've been in the industry for a long time, is the creation process in smaller teams, and there's scientific proof to that as well. Let's not go into too much detail with that, but I've been dealing with that a lot recently. Is very much like that. It's to say, like, a team up to a certain size is way more effective, and beyond that, it's becoming less effective, even if you have more projects at the same time. And it's a very interesting kind of way that you're saying this, because when we look into Li Xiang right now, it is a startup, but it's, you know, producing cars already. It's still a very small company, and it, from what you are telling me, is doesn't make sense to grow absolutely massively big for that one. Understanding China, there's a lot of startups. What made you actually go to for something like Li Xiang and not to one of the other 100 that are currently out there?
Actually, to be honest, I have to say I wasn't looking to go somewhere else. I really wanted to do my startup in Berlin, which is still side business now at the moment. They actually contacted me and through a friend, and they knew that I'm in Beijing, and I had like my first talks with the design director, and he was already super, super cool, and I was like, how the hell can he be design director? He's way too cool and way too open and way too nice for something like this. And he convinced me to come around to have a look and to also meet Li Xiang himself, like the 38-year-old founder and billionaire of this company. Basically, like they say, it's kind of a Chinese Elon Musk. And so I had my appointment with him, and he like drove me around through Beijing in the Li Xiang One. And this was actually, I have to say, like the three most interesting hours almost in my life so far, I have to say. It's just like there was a man sitting like in his 30s with a vision, you know, he wants to do something and he has a clear vision where he wants to be. And he wanted me to help him with that. And for me, first of all, it was a great honor. And second of all, I saw the potential in this brand with their very clean first car they did. And I could see where it's could be going. And then for me, after this talk, it was clear. Like, I was like, okay, I want to do it. And even the funny thing is, like, people think, yeah, he went for the money. And I didn't go for the money, because as a FSE, which means like as an external contract guy in Volkswagen, you earn a lot of money. Actually, I have not more than that now, but I have way, 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 way more fun. It's just like, it's a whole new world, actually.
How is it for you adapting to Chinese culture? In particular, obviously, as a Westerner, you've grown up in a very, let's say, planned organization in Porsche and Volkswagen as a whole. And now you're getting into China where the attitude is, let's get shit done, to be fair. How, obviously, you as a person absolutely love this, but how is this transitioning working for you? I mean, you must have the steepest learning curve every single day, understanding, you know, communicating, finding ways to get something to work without even speaking, you know, fluent Chinese in that kind of sense. So how do you manage? What's your recipe?
Her recipe is so basically I was raised treating every person like you would treat your brothers, and actually that's what I do. And that's in China, I have to say, it works perfectly, because people are, especially in this company, so friendly, and it's just such a nice vibe to work. I know it sounds a bit like I have my love goggles on or something, but it's really weird. I wouldn't have expected that at first, because actually I have to say, landing in China was like culture shock 1,000 2 years ago. Like, I was really, the first half year I was like, oh my god, what did I do? Oh no! But now I love it, and I think you have to get adapted in a certain kind of manners, or kind of you treat people differently. It's a bit more respectful in some ways, and a bit less respectful in other ways. And you have to first to really adapt to that. And like working in a startup here is just like, I would do my own startup as well. You know, it's just like, it's like short ways to the person who is actually doing something. And it's like short decisions. If I want to have a decision of my CEO, I just ask him, he comes around, his office is maybe 50 meters away. And then we just go for it. And this is super great, because I can tell you now, I'm 3 months here. We did almost one full car in 3 months, which is absolutely impossible in the German car industry, because first of all, you have to ask your chief designer, then the chief, or you have to ask your team leader. The team leader asks the chief designer. This guy asks maybe one guy of the board, then the board comes together, but the board comes together every 2 months. So, you know, like the decision making in these kind of brands is way, 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 way slower. And that makes it uninteresting for people who like to work fast.
This kind of experience with, you know, not just the quickness, but I think what is most important is the decision-making process in this entire system. Are you aware of yourself that this period can only continue for a certain amount of time? Because at some point, the company, depending on how many products you have, a design team can be small, but of course, you know, organizations have to grow, and you will need to have a certain amount of people. So not having that immediate access to the top level management will be there for forever. What are you doing right now to make sure you can extend this period for the longest time possible? Because especially in China, you know, growing companies is very important. There's also these kind of factors of, support from the government. Is the more people you have, the more support you will get because it helps to bring in employment. So what do you do to kind of find exactly that middle way at the moment to never lose that touch? Because we can see that with a lot of other companies on the startup level that have lost this touch, and then you can see it falling back onto the products again because it's the products are not just becoming that great anymore.
Yeah. In this company, it's actually pretty easy. That's what I was talking about earlier with the designers have to have a vision. Yixiang himself, he trusts us in creating his vision or in his, you know, he said once he doesn't know what he likes, but he knows what he doesn't like. So actually he knows that we can provide the vision for him and we can provide how the cars in the future can look like and what they could do already, like in how they would be positioned. And that's actually awesome to know that this guy is trusting us so much. And based on this trust, I don't think that that we will ever have problems like you would face in a traditional car company. Because actually design in here is on a very, very high level in the hierarchy of the company. So his great, like Li Xiang's great role model is actually Apple and Apple Design, the 20 Apple industrial designers who are responsible for every product which Apple is doing, even though there are, of course, way, way more designers than the 20 of the industrial group, you know. But it's basically the core design team which is defining the brand. And this is the way he wants to go. And I trust him by saying that.
It's for all the listeners, of course, 20 designers at Apple, 20 modelers as well. But you have, of course, especially on the more complex side with icons and stuff like that. But we're talking really about the industrial product process in there. And that has given them wonders, I think, in terms of the outcome. And I think actually learning from that kind of background and, you know, not putting Apple on the highest pedestal because there's been a lot of change, of course. And I think a lot of this was only with the trust of Johnny Ive that happened in there. I think it's actually a good idea for car companies to start thinking about something like that. Do we need that many people working on one car, or can we actually break it down and give the responsibility to the people? And that's a very interesting thought because, you know, look into a lot of companies nowadays, they have so many designers, you don't even know what you want to do with them.
Yeah, because it was always about just growing, just growing it. In what you learn in Volkswagen Group is you have to be important. What does it mean as a manager? You have to have a big team. Okay, and you have to have like teams under your team. That means like you're creating this whole ecostructure or this whole environment of sometimes really useless teams. And that's the only thing you learn actually when you want to come to a high position in these kind of groups, because it's a traditional way to do so. And I think there will be different solutions. As you mentioned earlier, there will be like you can get like work labor into your studio for short peak times, because to be honest, you're not always doing a new model, and then you have this like 30 designers sitting around. But if you have like quality designers who can come in for a short period of time, and you as the core team still have in mind how your brand should look like, then it's super easy to get around every peak which will happen, you know.
Yeah, and it's also a question of like, you know, changing the model ranges. I mean, what we're seeing right now, and especially in China, is that the life cycles are just shorter, which also means that you need to be more adaptable with the entire team, and especially in creative teams. And I don't want to say you know reacting to trends, but it's just like, you know, reacting to the customers, reacting to what's happening around you, and trying to predict as well what the next thing is going to happen. And that only happens if you have a certain fluidity in your team. If you don't get that, you might end up on these in these design teams where the people have been sitting there for 20-25 years. Nothing against them, but at some point, if you don't push them regularly, they will almost become like part of the inventory, in that sense. And that's, I think, what the smaller companies, the startup companies can avoid, but it's also something that the bigger companies, I mean, especially someone like Porsche, would actually do well with. You know, I mean, why not bring in a Sasha Silipanov for a few months and ask him to do, you know, a new GT or something like that, you know, or bring someone in who comes in from an SUV background if you want to do a new one. Like, have the specialists come in for a certain amount of time to give you ideas, or trend researchers or whatever. There's all these different kind of ideas. I think we shouldn't take ourselves too serious that everything needs to be done in-house, but enjoy this kind of sharing factor, you know, of what it's all about. And in the end, I mean, you know, the conversations we had about your startup with OHE is very similar to that. You know, it's about what is progressive, what is new, but progressive is never something that is just from one day to another. It has to always continue, you know, and this kind of continuous thought is, I think, you know, companies that are in startup phase are much more flexible to incorporate.
Definitely, definitely. I can see that here. And of course, it's of course you also can't really compare it, because a company which grew like in the last 50, 60 years is of course way, way different to something which is just existing for 5. And yeah, but for me, like personally, it's just about, you know, like about, I'm a person who gets bored quickly. So for me, it's fun. It's a lot of fun to work in a kind of this environment. And that's why I like it. So
yeah.
And it's creative. So let me ask about creativity. That's the thing.
Let me ask you one interesting thing. The first car that Li Xiang did was an SUV.
Yeah.
Did that cause a little bit of problem with you personally? Is that you said like, oh, it's an SUV? Or, because you mentioned like, you know, how strong the vision was and that you believed in the vision. So it obviously sounds to me that you believe more in the vision than seeing the car. But was there a little bit something in you and just like, okay, there is this risk factor that we're just doing SUVs?
No, actually not. Because in this case, it makes sense to make SUVs. Because, you know, like Li Xiang himself, he did. He has this platform called Autohome or Chehejia, like the biggest website for car research on the planet. Actually, like I think they are like stock. Like they have like worth of $12 billion US dollars at the moment. He sold this company before, but he has still like the information from that company, and so he knows exactly what the customer wants. And the Chinese, and these cars are for the Chinese tier 2, tier 3, and tier 4 cities, where there is no electrical infrastructure to charge a fully equipped car like NIO or Tesla, but where the people want to drive, because Chinese people are family people. They want to drive with their child or with the 2 childs they can have now, and with their grandpa and grandma. So this car is actually a 6- or 7-seater. And it's made for family use, and it's made for bad streets or like not the perfect environment where you could drive a limousine or something else. And he could explain me exactly why this car looks like that. And that made it for me followable. You know, I could follow his thoughts and then I could see his vision, which is kind of sad to say, but at Porsche, nobody has that, you know. They're just like, oh yeah, maybe we should do that. Maybe we should do this. Even like, I have to say, like, even the CEOs, they are kind of course, they're brought up in this company, but they don't have a big vision behind, because they didn't found the company. They didn't start this. They are employees as well. And so this was actually very astonishing for me to meet a person like this, like with fire, you know. It's just a person with fire.
How do you deal with all that data? I mean, for your design process itself, I mean, you've been there for like 3 months now, so it's very relatively still very, very early on. But if you have access to all of this data, which is, let's be honest, it's absolute gold just to have that. Do you start a design process then differently as you would do as, you know, just like, oh, here's the 992 or like, let's do a 914. Do you think differently because you have this data? Okay, so we should probably do this and we should probably do that because we have this information.
Definitely, yes. But just more into in a way of how you use the products. Not about styling, because like actually in a styling way, Li Xiang trusts us as a team. He says like, okay, you do it, you make it look like this and that, or like actually we told him how we want to make it look. And he said, okay, you make it look like this. But in case of which class car are we making, like which size, which wheelbase, which components are inside, then we can of course have like this kind of data has a big impact on us. And we can basically really customize our proportion models and our interiors to a certain fact or to a certain way, in a certain way.
Interesting. I mean, to talk about just that, we should probably revisit in about a year's time. Yeah. Because then you have more data, you have a higher source. I mean, like, you know, you mentioned you did one car, but I would love to speak about this with, you know, data-based approach. Not obviously in an artificial intelligence. And I think we should be very straightforward to this. It's like, this is not data, putting it into the computer and then there's a design coming out. It's like using and understanding data and making decisions why then, you know, a car should have a certain kind of feature improved. But we should talk about this again in about a year's time when you've worked on a few more projects, because then we can go into much more detail on understanding how important that data actually is. Mm-hmm. And yeah, but before I let you go, because I do really appreciate that you've taken, like, you know, 40 minutes out of your day that we talk about these things. It's super interesting. But you, as every guest on the show, will get the three questions.
Okay.
And answer them straight out of your gut.
Okay.
Not too much thinking to them, because that's always the most honest and the best answer. But two projects, or the two first questions, are not related to a car or transportation. So you can answer the first two on anything. The first, the third one is the car question. Yeah. But we start with the non-car ones. Which project you did not participate in, you would have absolutely loved to be a part of? And this doesn't have to be a car. It can be anything at any time that you can imagine.
Oh, that's a trick question, man. Ooh, is there so many projects. Actually, you know what? The cake bike. Right, cake. I love this brand. And I love how Stefan created this kind of brand around it. I would have loved to be part of creation, like part of the creation of that brand. Not about the design or anything, but just about the brand creation. That would have been cool.
All right. Question number two. Which designer you have or have not worked with had the biggest influence on your creative career?
Wow. That actually... There's a lot of designers who had like a very big influence.
Yeah. You can mention a few as well. It's just to get a little bit of a gist, like where your inspiration came from.
Yeah. So early on, I was really inspired by BMW design. So by the first BMW Z4, who was the design boss back in the days?
Was that Daniel? I think was that.
I actually can't remember, but. But but you know, like this kind of surfacing was like so amazing and was so nice and so fresh and so clean and new that this was really driving me towards wanting to become a designer. And later on in my professional life, I had like a lot of teachers, because I have to say, like, I wasn't the most talented guy, but I'm a quick learner. And I had good teachers. Like the guy I learned the most recently would definitely be Emil Burki, like the guy behind Mission E. But of course, also bosses who kind of encouraged you to follow your vision or to follow your kind of design, which would be my first. Like actually, the guy who brought me to Porsche, Matthias Kuller, which was a great guy, like a great boss in his philosophical thinking behind a brand and behind form and form language, because he always encouraged to make something which follows your feeling and encourage the designer to work on their own character. Yeah, but there actually I have a lot of examples in this. I have like also guys I was like admiring when I was studying, you know, like for example Moritz Martin with his awesome with his awesome diploma work he did, or Florian Flatow, or who else can you say? Sasha, definitely, with his like angry Sasha car design blog, you know. Like, man, this guy seems to be cool. I was like always, hanging around on his when he had, still had his Blogspot thingy, which he closed down. I was really, really nice. It was kind of this first learning like period where you have a lot of influence from a lot of different designers.
It's actually not one, it's a lot. Just to add on the BMW Z4, so the first generation called the model name E89.
Yeah, exactly.
It was done by Anders. And it says here on I'm on Wikipedia at the moment, so if anybody has more insight on that, I actually can ask Anders as well. It was done from mid-1998 to the summer of 1999.
Yeah.
And the lead design was by Anders Worming, and the coupe models were done by Thomas Sicher, who is now at Mini. I think he's head of exterior at Mini. And this was all done in the Bengel era.
Yeah,
And it was developed then further was from the Gina and everything. So,
People will hate me like when I say now I really like the Bengel era of BMW design, but I really like that. I could get his thinking, you know. I know how this guy thinks. And that's why these cars were kind of cool for me. I can't understand the new form language of BMW. I can understand that people like it, but for me, I can't follow it, so I can't really relate my kind of design to it. But
All right. Last but not least, if I give you a blank check, which car would you buy?
A blank check.
Blank check. Whatever money you need.
Can I buy two?
I'll give you two.
Okay. So I would like to have my Datsun 240Z back.
Nice.
Because I sold that before I went to China.
Which color did you have?
Black, everything black.
Wow.
Black in and out.
Nice.
And then I would, because this is like a really old car and it's like you can't drive it every day. And then I would want, now I'm stuck because I would want so many cars actually.
That's what I'm saying, you know, it's usually this kind of gut feeling. It's like this first car, like the first couple of cars, boom, come to you, might like run away.
What's funny, I had the BMW i8 in my mind, but just because I just saw some black on black, everything black i8 driving around here in Beijing in the like 2 days ago. And it looks so fucking cool in this, like, you know, like this city full of skyscrapers, these reflections of the skyscrapers in that car. And then I was driving with my electric scooter behind it. And I was like, oh yeah, that's fucking awesome. I was like waving to the guy. And the guy, of course, because I'm like a very blonde foreigner, was like waving back. And he's like, oh, hey, nice. And I was like, cool car. And he's like, yeah, nice. So actually I would take the i8 and the Datsun.
Datsun. I'll take that all day long. Ben, thank you very much for taking the time
and
for being so open and sharing with all of us. And to our listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode. This went really from very traditional to a startup very quickly and shows you the range of that we have nowadays in transportation design. But as always, if you enjoyed this recording of the Gestalten podcast, whichever channel you're listening to us, if you can rate us, give us a high rating, always helps us as well. And once again, Ben, thank you very much. And we will be back in a couple of weeks' time with the next episode of the Gestalten podcast. And until then, bye-bye.